And next time you cross, maybe that line smudges a little more. But you have your bearings. No matter what happens to that line, you remember where it is. Don't you? There was a mirror above the fully stocked bar in Stephen Bacar's office. His interior decorator had insisted that all people of prestige had to have a place to toast their successes. So he had one. He didn't even drink. Stephen Bacard stared at his reflection and thought, not for the first time in his life, average. He had always been average. His grades in school, his SAT and LSAT scores, his law school ranking, his bar score. He passed it on the third attempt. If life were a game where children choose sides for kickball, he'd be picked in the middle of the pack, after the good athletes and before the really bad ones, in that cusp for those who leave no mark. Bacard became a lawyer because he believed that being a JD would give him a level of prestige. It didn't. No one hired him. He opened up his own pitiful office near the Patterson courthouse, sharing space with a bail bondsman. He ambulance-chased, but even as a member of this small-time pack, he couldn't distinguish himself. He managed to marry a woman slightly above his station, though she reminded him of that as often as she could. Where Bacard had indeed been below average, way below average, was in sperm count. Try as he might. And Dawn, his wife, didn't really like him to try. He could not impregnate his wife. After 4 years, they tried to adopt. Again, Stephen Bacard fit into the abyss of the great unspectacular, which made finding a white baby, something Dawn truly craved, nearly impossible. He and Dawn traveled to Romania, but the only children available were too old or born drug-addled. But it was there, overseas, in that God-deserted place, that Stephen Bacard finally came up with an idea that, after 38 years, made him rise above the crowd. "Problem, Stephen?" The voice startled him. He turned away from his reflection. Lydia stood in the shadows. "Staring in the mirror like that," Lydia said, adding a tsk tsk at the end. "Wasn't that Narcissus's downfall?" Bacard could not help it. He began to tremble. It wasn't just Lydia, though in truth she often had that effect on him. The phone call had set him on edge. Lydia popping up like that. That was the clincher. He had no idea how she'd gotten in or how long she'd been standing there. He wanted to ask what had happened tonight. He wanted details. But there was no time. "We do indeed have a problem," Bacard said. "Tell me." Her eyes chilled him. They were big and luminous and beautiful, and yet you sensed nothing behind them. Only a cold chasm, windows to a house long abandoned. What Bacard had discovered while in Romania, what had finally helped him rise above the pack, was a way to beat the system. Suddenly, for the first time in his life, Bacard was on a roll. He stopped chasing ambulances. People started looking up to him. He was invited to fundraisers. He became a sought-after speaker. His wife, Dawn, started to smile at him again and ask him about his day. He even appeared on News 12, New Jersey, when the cable station needed a certain kind of legal expert. He stopped, however, when a colleague overseas reminded him of the danger of too much publicity. Besides, he no longer needed to attract clients. They found him, these parents searching for a miracle. The desperate have always done that, like plants stretching through the dark for any sliver of sunlight. And he, Stephen Bacard, was that sunlight. He pointed to the phone. I just got a call. And? The ransom money is bugged, he said. We switched bags. Not just the bags. There's some kind of device in the money. Between the bills or something. Lydia's face clouded over. Your source didn't know about this before? My source didn't know about any of it until just now. So what you're telling me, she said slowly, is that while we stand here, the police know exactly where we are? Not the police, he said. The bug wasn't planted by the cops or the feds. That seemed to surprise her. Then Lydia nodded. Dr. Seidman? Not exactly. He has a woman named Rachel Mills helping him. She used to be a fed. Lydia smiled as if this explained something. And this Rachel Mills, this ex-fed, she's the one who bugged the money. Yes. Is she following us right now? No one knows where she is, Bacard said. No one knows where Seidman is either. She said. The police think this Rachel woman is involved. Lydia lifted her chin. Involved in the original kidnapping? And the murder of Monica Seidman. Lydia liked that. She smiled, and Bacard felt a fresh shiver slink down his back. Was she, Stephen? He teetered. I wouldn't know. Ignorance is bliss. That it? Bacard chose to say nothing. Lydia said, Do you have the gun? He stiffened. What? Seidman's gun. Do you have it? Bacard did not like this. He felt as if he were sinking. He considered lying, but then he saw those eyes. Yes. Get it, she said. How about Pavel? Have you heard from him? He's not happy with any of this. He wants to know what's going on. We'll call him in the car. We? Yes. Now let's hurry, Stephen. I'm coming with you? Indeed. What are you going to do? Lydia put her fingers to her lips. Shh, she said. I have a plan. Rachel said, They're on the move again. How long did they stop? I asked. Maybe 5 minutes. They could have met up with someone and transferred the money. Or maybe they were just getting gas. Turn right here. We pulled up on Centura Road off Route 3. Giant stadium loomed in the distance. About a mile up, Rachel pointed out the window. They were somewhere over there. The sign read Metro Vista, and the parking lot appeared to be a never-ending expanse, disappearing in the distant marsh. Metro Vista was a classic New Jersey office complex built during the Great Expanse of the 80s. Hundreds of offices, all cold and impersonal, sleek and robotic, with too many tinted windows letting in not enough sunlight. The vapor lights buzzed, and you can imagine, if not actually hear, the drone of worker bees. They weren't stopping for gas, Rachel muttered. So what do we do? Only thing we can, she said. Let's keep following the money. Heshi and Lydia headed west toward the Garden State Parkway. Stephen Bacard followed in the car behind them. Lydia ripped open the wads of bills. It took her 10 minutes to find the tracking device. She dug it out from the money crevice. She held it up so Heshi could see it. Clever, she said. Or we're slipping. We've never been perfect, Pooh Bear. Heshi did not reply. Lydia opened the car window. She stuck her hand out and signaled for Bacard to follow them. He waved back that he understood. When they slowed for the toll, Lydia quickly pecked Heshi's cheek and got out of the car. She took the money with her. Heshi was now left alone with just the tracking device. If this Rachel woman still had any juice, or if the police got wind of what was happening, they would pull Heshi over. He would toss the tracking device into the street. They would find the device, sure, but they wouldn't be able to prove it had come from his car. And even if they could, so what? They would search Heshi and his car and find nothing. No kid, no ransom note, no ransom money. He was clean. Lydia hurried over to Stephen Bacard's car and slipped into the passenger side. You got Pavel on the line? She asked. Yes. She took the phone. Pavel started screaming in whatever the hell language was native to him. She waited and then told him the meeting place. When Bacard heard the address, his head snapped toward her. She smiled. Pavel, of course, didn't understand the significance of the location, but then again, why should he? He ranted a little more, but eventually Pavel calmed enough to say he'd be there. She hung up the phone. You can't be serious, Bacard said to her. Shh. Her plan was simple enough. Lydia and Bacard would race ahead to the meeting spot while Heshi, who had the tracker on him, would stall. When Lydia was set up and fully prepared, she would call Heshi on the cell phone. Then, and only then, would Heshi go to the meeting spot. He would have the tracking device with him. The woman, this Rachel Mills, would hopefully follow. She and Bacard arrived in 20 minutes. Lydia spotted a car parked up the block. Pavel's, she figured. A stolen Toyota Celica. Lydia didn't like that. Strange cars parked on streets like these were noticed. She glanced over at Stephen Bacard. His face was moon pale. It almost seemed detached, floating. The scent of fear came off him in waves. His fingers gripped the wheel, tense. Bacard didn't have the stomach for this. That would be a liability. You can just drop me off, she said. I want to know, he began, what you plan on doing here. She just looked at him. My God! Spare me the indignant act. No one was supposed to be hurt. You mean like Monica Seidman? We had nothing to do with that. Lydia shook her head. And the sister, what was her name? Stacy Seidman. Bacard opened his mouth as though he might counter. Then he lowered his head. She knew what he had planned on saying. Stacy Seidman had been a drug addict. She was expendable. A waste, a danger, heading for death, whatever justification floated his boat. Men like Bacard needed justification. In his mind, he wasn't selling babies. He really believed that he was helping. And if he made money, lots of money from it, and broke the law, well, he was taking tremendous risk to better lives. Shouldn't he be well compensated? But Lydia had no interest in digging into his psyche, nor comforting it. She had counted the money in the car. He had hired her. Her take was $1 million. Bacard got the other million. She shouldered the duffel bag with her and Heshy's money. She stepped out of the car. Stephen Bacard stared straight ahead. He did not refuse the money. He did not call her back and say that he wanted to wash his hands of this. There was $1 million sitting in the seat next to him. Bacard wanted it. His family had a big house in Alpine now. His kids went to private school. So no, Bacard did not back off. He simply stared ahead and put the car in drive. When he was gone, Lydia called Pavel with the two-way radio portion of the cell phone. Pavel was hiding behind some shrubs up the block. He still wore the flannel shirt. His walk was a labored lumber. His teeth had suffered under a lifetime of cigarettes and ill care. He had a squashed from too many fights nose. He was Balkan rough trade. He had seen a lot in his life. Didn't matter, though. When you don't know what's happening, you are in over your head. "You," he said, spitting the word. "You no tell me." Pavel was right. She no tell him. In other words, he'd known nothing. His English was beyond broken, which was why he had been the perfect front man for this crime. He'd come over from Kosovo 2 years ago with a pregnant woman. During the first ransom drop, Pavel had been given specific instructions. He'd been told to wait for a certain car to pull into the lot, to approach the car without speaking to the man, to take a bag from him, to get into the van. Oh, and to confuse matters a little more, they told Pavel to keep a phone in front of his mouth and pretend to talk into it. That was it. Pavel had no idea who Mark Seidman was. He had no idea about what was in the bag, about a kidnapping, about a ransom, nothing. He didn't wear his gloves. His fingerprints were not on file in the United States, and he didn't carry ID. They paid him $2,000 and sent him back to Kosovo. Based on Seidman's rather specific description, the police circulated a sketch of a man who, for all practical purposes, was impossible to find. When they decided to rerun the ransom drop, Pavel was the natural go-to guy. He would dress the same, look the same, play with Seidman's head in case he decided to fight back this time. Still, Pavel was a realist. He would adapt. He had spent time selling women in Kosovo. White slavery in the guise of strip clubs was a big market over there, though Bacard had come up with another way of using those women. Pavel, no stranger to sudden change, would do what needed to be done. He gave Lydia some attitude, but once she handed him a wad of bills adding up to $5,000, he grew quiet. The fight was out of him. It was only a question of how. She handed Pavel a gun. He knew how to use it. Pavel sat up near the driveway, keeping his two-way radio channel open. Lydia called Heshy and told them they were ready. 15 minutes later, Heshy drove past them. He tossed the tracking device out the car window. Lydia caught it and threw back a kiss. Heshy kept driving. Lydia brought the tracking device into the backyard. She took out her gun and waited. The night air was starting to give way to the morning dew. That tingle was there, lighting up her veins. Heshy, she knew, was not far away. He wanted to join in, but this was her game. The street was silent. It was 4 a.m. 5 minutes later, she heard the car pull up. Chapter 32. Something was very wrong here. The roads were becoming so familiar I barely noticed them. I was wired, jazzed, the pain in my ribs barely noticeable. Rachel was absorbed in her Palm Pilot. She'd click screens with a little wand, tilt her head, change viewing angles. She dug through the back seat and found Zia's road atlas. With the cap of the flare pen in her mouth, Rachel started marking up the route, trying to discern a pattern, I guess. Or maybe she was just stalling, so I wouldn't ask the inevitable. I called her name softly. She flicked her eyes at me and then back to the screen. "Did you know about that CD-ROM before you got here?" I said. "No." "There were photos of you in front of the hospital where I work." "So you told me." She clicked the screen again. "Are the photos real?" I asked. "Real? I mean, were they digitally altered or something? Or were you really in front of my office 2 years ago?" Rachel kept her head down, but out of the corner of my eye I could see her shoulders slump. "Make a right," she said. "Up here." We were on Glen Avenue now. This was getting creepy. My old high school was up on the left. They'd refurbished it 4 years ago, adding a weight room, a swimming pool, and a second gymnasium. The facade had been intentionally scuffed up and aged with ivy, giving the place a proper collegiate feel, reminding the youth of Castleton what was expected of them. "Rachel?" "The pictures are real, Mark." I nodded to myself. I don't know why. Maybe I was trying to buy myself some time. I was heading into something worse than uncharted waters here. I knew that the answers would alter everything again, make it all go topsy-turvy just when I hoped to set the world right. "I think I'm owed an explanation," I said. "You are." She kept her head down on the screen. "But not right now." "Yeah, right now. We need to concentrate on what we're doing. Don't hand me that crap. We're just driving here. I can handle two things at the same time." "Maybe," she said softly, "I can't." "Rachel, what were you doing in front of that hospital?" "Whoa." "Whoa, what?" We were approaching the traffic lights at Castleton Avenue. Because of the hour, they were blinking yellow and red. I frowned and turned to her. "Which way?" "Right." My heart iced. "I don't understand." "The car has stopped again."
"Where?"
"Unless I'm reading this wrong," Rachel said, and finally she looked up and met my gaze. "They're at your house." I made the right turn. Rachel no longer needed to direct me. She kept her eyes on the screen. We were less than a mile away now. My parents had taken this route to the hospital on the day I was born. I wondered how many times I'd been on this road since. Weird thought, but the mind goes where it must. I made the right on Monroe. My parents' house was on the left. The lights were off except, of course, for the lamp downstairs. We had it on a timer. It stayed on from 7 p.m. to 5 a.m. every day. I'd put in one of those long-life, energy-saving light bulbs that looked like soft ice cream swirls. Mom bragged about how long it lasted. She'd read somewhere that keeping a radio on was also a good way to scare away burglars, so she had an old AM radio constantly tuned into a talk station. The problem was the sound of the radio kept her up at night, so now Mom put the volume so low that a burglar would have to press his ear against it to be warded off. I started making the turn onto my road, onto Darby Terrace, when Rachel said, "Slow down." "They moving?" "No. The signal is still coming from your house." I looked up the block. I started thinking about it. They didn't exactly take a direct route here. She nodded. "I know." "Maybe they found your cue logger," I said. "That's exactly what I was thinking." The car inched forward. We were in front of the Citron's house now, two away from mine. No lights were on, not even a timer lamp. Rachel chewed on her lower lip. We were at the Cadison's house now, nearing my driveway. It was one of those situations people describe as too quiet. As if the world had frozen. As if all you saw, even animate objects, were trying to stay still. "This has to be a setup," she said. I was just about to ask her what we should do. Pull back, park and walk, call the cops for help, when the first bullet shattered the front windshield. Shards of glass smacked my face. I heard a short scream. Without conscious thought, I ducked my head and raised my forearm. I looked down and saw blood. "Rachel!" The second shot zinged so close to my head that I felt it in my hair. The impact hit my seat with a sound like a pillowy wallop. Instincts took over again. But this time, it had a mission. A direction of sorts. I hit the accelerator. The car lurched forward. The human brain is an amazing instrument. No computer can duplicate it. It can process millions of stimuli in hundreds of a second. That was, I guess, what was going on now. I was hunched over in the driver's seat. Someone was taking shots at me. The base part of my brain wanted to flee, but something farther along the evolutionary path realized that there might be a better way. The thought process took, and this is just a rough estimate, less than a tenth of a second. I had my foot on the accelerator. The tires shrieked. I thought about my house, the familiar setup of it, the direction the bullets had come from. Yes, I know how that sounds. Maybe panic speeds up those brain functions, I don't know, but I realized that if I were the one doing the shooting, if I had been lying in wait for this car to approach, I'd have hidden behind the three shrubs that divide my property from the Christie's next door. The shrubs were big and bushy and right on our driveway. If I had pulled all the way in, bam, you could have blown us away from the passenger side. When I hesitated, when the shooter had seen that we might back away, he was still in position, though not as good, to take us from the front. So I looked up, turned the wheel, and aimed the car for those bushes. A third bullet rang out. It hit something metal, probably the front grill, with a ka-ping. I sneaked a glance at Rachel long enough to take a visual snapshot. Her head was down, her hand pressed against the side of her head, blood seeping through the fingers. My stomach fell, but my foot stayed on the pedal. I moved my head back and forth as if that might throw off the shooter's aim. My headlights illuminated the bushes. I saw flannel. Something happened to me. I talked before about sanity being a thin string and that mine had snapped. In that case, I went quiet. This time, a mix of rage and dread roared through my body. I pressed the pedal harder, almost through the floor. I heard a yell of surprise. The man in the flannel shirt tried to leap to the right. But I was ready. I turned the steering wheel toward him like we were playing bumper cars. There was a crash, a dull thud. I heard a scream. The bushes were caught up in the bumper. I looked for the man in the flannel. Nothing. I had my hand on the door handle, about to open it and go after him, when Rachel said, "No!" I stopped. She was alive. Her hand reached up and shifted the car in reverse. "Go back!" I listened. I don't know what I'd been thinking. The man was armed. I wasn't. Despite the impact, I didn't know if he was dead or injured or what. I started back. I noticed that my dark suburban street was lit up now. Shots and shrieking tires are not common noises here on Darby Terrace. People had woken up and turned on the lights. They'd be dialing 911. Rachel sat up. Relief flooded me. She had a gun in one hand. The other was still over her wound. "It's my ear," she said, and again the mind working in funny ways. I had already started thinking about what procedure I would use to repair the damage. "There," she shouted. I turned. The man in the flannel was hobbling down the driveway. I turned the wheel and aimed the car lights in his direction. He disappeared around back. I looked over at Rachel. "Back up," she said. "I'm not sure he's alone." I did. "Now what?" Rachel had her gun out, her free hand on the door handle. "You stay." "Are you out of your mind? You keep revving the engine and moving a little. Let them think we're still in the car. I'll sneak up on them." Before I could protest any further, she rolled out. With blood still flowing down her side, she darted away. I, per her instructions, revving the engine and feeling like a total dweeb, shifted the car in forward, moved forward, shifted the car in reverse, went back. A few seconds later, I lost sight of Rachel. A few seconds after that, I heard two more shots. Lydia had watched it all from her spot in the backyard. Pavel had shot too early. It was a mistake on his part. From her vantage point behind a wall of firewood, Lydia could not see who was in the car. But she'd been impressed. The driver had not only flushed Pavel out, but wounded him as well. Pavel limped into view. Lydia's eyes adjusted enough to see the blood on his face. She raised her arm and waved him toward her. Pavel fell and then started crawling. Lydia kept her eyes on the routes to the backyard. They would have to come from the front. There was a fence behind her. She was near the back neighbor's gate in case she needed to escape. Pavel kept crawling. Lydia urged him on while keeping watch. She wondered how this ex-fed would play it. The neighbors were awake now. Lights were going on. The cops would be on their way. Lydia would have to hurry. Pavel made it to the pile of firewood and rolled next to her. For a moment, he stayed on his back. His breathing was wheezy and wet. Then he forced himself up. He knelt next to Lydia and looked out into the yard. He winced and said, "Leg broken." "We'll take care of it," she said. "Where's your gun?"
"Dropped."
Untraceable, she thought. Not a problem. "I have another weapon you can use," she told him. "Keep a lookout." Pavel nodded. He squinted into the dark. "What?" Lydia said. She moved a little closer to him.
"Not sure."
As Pavel stared out, Lydia pressed the barrel of her gun against the hollow spot behind his left ear. She squeezed the trigger, firing two shots into his head. Pavel dropped to the ground like a marionette, with his strings cut. Lydia looked down at him. "In the end, this might be best. Plan B was probably better than Plan A anyway. Had Pavel killed the woman, an ex-FBI agent, that would not have ended it. They'd probably search even harder for the mysterious man in flannel. The investigation would have continued. There wouldn't be closure. This way, with Pavel dead, dead by the gun used at the original Seidman crime scene, the police would conclude that either Seidman or this Rachel, or both, was behind it. They'd be arrested. The charges might not stick, but no matter. The police would stop looking for anyone else. They could disappear with the money now. Case closed. Lydia suddenly heard the shriek of tire wheels. She tossed the weapon into the neighbor's yard. She didn't want it in plain sight. That would be too obvious. She quickly checked Pavel's pockets. There was money, of course, the wad of bills she'd just given him. She'd let him keep that. One more thing to tie it all up nice and neat. There was nothing else in his pockets. No wallet, no slip of paper, no identification or anything that could trace back to anything. Pavel had been good about that. More lights in windows now. Not much time. Lydia rose. Federal agent, drop your weapon. Damn. A woman's voice. Lydia fired toward where she thought the voice had originated from and ducked back behind the firewood. Shots came back in her direction. She was pinned down. What now? Still behind the firewood, Lydia stretched up behind her and released the gate hatch. All right, Lydia shouted. I'm surrendering. Then she jumped up with a semi-automatic already going. She pulled the trigger as fast as she could. Bullets flew, the sound ringing in her ears. She didn't know if the shots were being returned or not. She didn't think so. There was no hesitation, though. The gate was open. She darted through it. Lydia ran hard. 100 yards away, Heshy was waiting in a neighbor's yard. They met up. Keeping low, they followed a trail of recently pruned shrubs. Heshy was good. He always tried to prepare for the worst. His car was hidden in a cul-de-sac 2 blocks down. When they were safely on their way, Heshy asked, "You okay?" "Fine, Pooh Bear." She took a deep breath, closed her eyes, and settled back. "Just fine." It wasn't until they were near the highway that Lydia wondered what had happened to Pavel's cell phone. My first reaction, naturally enough, was panic. I opened the car door to give chase, but my brain finally kicked in and made me pull up. It was one thing to be brave or even foolhardy. It was another to be suicidal. I did not have a gun. Both Rachel and her assailant did. Rushing to her aid unarmed would be at best fruitless. But I couldn't just stay here. I closed the car door. Once again, my foot stamped down on the accelerator. The car bolted forward. I spun the wheel and veered across my front lawn. The shots had come from the back of the house. I aimed the car there. I tore through the flower beds and shrubs. They had been here so long that I almost cared. My headlights danced through the dark. I started toward the right, hoping that I could work around the big elm. No go. The tree was too close to the house. The car wouldn't fit. I floored it in reverse. The tires ripped into dewy lawn, taking a second or two to catch. I headed toward the Christie's property line. I took out their new gazebo. Bill Christie would be pissed. I was in the backyard now. The headlights slipped along the Grossman's stockade fence. I swung the steering wheel toward the right. And then I saw her. I hit the brake. Rachel stood by the pile of firewood. The wood had been there when we bought the house. We hadn't used any. It was probably rotten and bug-infested. The Grossmans had complained that it was so close to their fence that the bugs would start eating into it. I had promised to get rid of it, but I hadn't yet gotten around to it. Rachel had her gun drawn and pointing down. The man in the flannel was lying at her feet, like yesterday's refuse. I didn't have to roll down a window. The windshield was gone from the earlier gunshots. I heard nothing. Rachel lifted her hand. She waved to me, signaling that it was okay. I hurried out of the car. "You shot him?" I asked, almost rhetorically. "No," she said. The man was dead. He didn't have to be a doctor to see that. The back of his skull had been blown off. Brain matter, congealed and pink-white, clung to the firewood. I'm not an expert on ballistics, but the damage was severe. It was either a very large bullet or from very close range. "Someone was with him," Rachel said. "They shot him and escaped through that gate." I stared down at him. The rage boiled up again. "Who is he?" I checked his pockets. He had a wad of bills, but no ID. I wanted to kick him. I wanted to shake him and ask what he had done with my daughter. I looked at his face, damaged yet handsome, and wondered what had led him here, why our life paths had crossed. And that was when I noticed something odd. I tilted my head to the side. "Mark?" I dropped to my knees. Brain matter did not bother me. Bone splinters and bloody tissue did not faze me in the least. I had seen worse trauma. I examined his nose. It was practically putty. I remembered that from last time. A boxer, I'd thought. Either that or he'd lived some rough years. His head lolled back at a funny angle. His mouth was open. That was what had drawn my eye. I put my fingers on his jaw and palate and pulled his mouth farther open. "What the hell are you doing?" Rachel asked. "Do you have a flashlight?" "No." Didn't matter. I lifted his head up and aimed his mouth toward the car. The headlights did the trick. I could see clearly now. "Mark?" It always bothered me that he let me see his face. I lowered my head toward his mouth, trying to do so without casting too much of a shadow. They were so careful about everything else. The altered voice, the stolen van sign, the welding together of license plates. Yet he lets me see his face. "What are you talking about?" I thought maybe he'd worn an elaborate disguise the first time I'd seen him. That would make sense. But now we know that's not the case. So why would he let me see him? She seemed taken aback that I was asserting myself, but that didn't last long. She joined in. "Because he had no record." "Maybe. Or..." "Or what? Mark, we don't have time for this." "His dental work." "What about it? Look at his crowns. They're tin cans." "They're what?" I lifted my head. "On his upper right molar and upper left cuspid. See? Our crowns used to be made of gold, though most are now porcelain. Your dentist makes a mold so you can get an exact fitting. But this is just an aluminum, ready-made cap. You put it over the teeth and squeeze it on with pliers. I did 2 oral rotations overseas, mostly dealing with reconstruction, but I saw lots of mouths with these things in them. They call them tin cans, and they don't do it here in the USA, except maybe as a temporary." She took a knee next to me, He's foreign?
I nodded. I'd bet he's from the old Soviet bloc, something like that. The Balkans, maybe?
That would make sense, she said.
Whatever prints they'd find, they'd send down to NCIC. Same with any sort of face ID. Our files and computers wouldn't pick him up. Hell, it'll take the police forever to ID him unless someone comes forward. Which probably won't happen.
My God. That's why they killed him. They know that we won't be able to trace him back.
The sirens sounded. Our eyes locked. You got a choice to make here, Mark. We stay, we're going to jail. They'll think he was part of our plot and we killed him. My guess is the kidnappers knew that. Your neighbors will claim it was quiet until we drove up. Suddenly, there's shrieking tires and gunfire. I'm not saying that we won't be able to explain it eventually.
But it will take time, I said.
Yes.
And whatever opening we have here, it will close. The cops will pursue it their own way. Even if they can help, even if they believe us, they'll make a lot of noise.
One more thing, she said.
What?
The kidnappers set us up. They knew about the Q-logger.
We figured that out already.
But now, I'm wondering, Mark, how did they find it?
I looked up, remembering the warning in the ransom note.
A leak?
I wouldn't rule it out anymore. We both started toward the car. I put my hand on her arm. She was still bleeding. Her eye was almost swollen shut now. I looked at her, and again, something primitive took over. I wanted to protect her.
If we run, it'll make us look guilty, I said.
I don't mind that. I don't have anything to lose here.
But what about you?
Her voice was soft.
I don't have anything to lose either.
You need a doctor, I said.
Rachel almost smiled.
Aren't you one?
True enough. There was no time to discuss the pros and cons. We had to act. We got into Zia's car. I swerved it around and headed out the back way, the Woodland Road exit.
Thoughts, rational, clear thoughts, were starting to filter in now.
When I really considered where we were and what we were doing, the truth nearly crushed me. I almost pulled over.
Rachel saw it.
What? She said.
Why are we running?
I don't understand.
We hoped to find my daughter, or at least who did this to her. We said there was a small opening.
Yes? But don't you see? The opening, if there ever really was one, is gone.
That guy back there is dead.
We know he's foreign, but so what? We don't know who he is. We've reached a dead end. We don't have any other clues.
There was suddenly a trace of mischief on Rachel's face. She reached into her pocket and pulled something into view. A cell phone. It wasn't mine. It wasn't hers.
Maybe, she said, we do.
Chapter 33. First thing, Rachel said, we need to get rid of this car.
Car, I said, shaking my head at the damage. If this search doesn't kill me, Zia will.
Rachel managed another smile. We were in the zone now, so deep in, so far past scared that we had found a little quiet. I debated where we should go, but really there was only one alternative.
Lenny and Cheryl, I said.
What about them?
They live 4 blocks from here.
It was 5 in the morning. Dark had begun to surrender to the inevitable. I dialed Lenny's home number and hoped that he hadn't gone back to the hospital. He answered on the first ring and barked a hello. I got a problem, I said. I hear sirens. That would be part of the problem. The police called me, he said, after you took off. I need your help. Is Rachel with you? He asked. Yes. There was an awkward silence. Rachel fiddled with the dead man's cell phone. I had no idea what she was looking for. Then Lenny said, What are you trying to do here, Mark? Find Tara. Are you going to help me or not? Now there was no hesitation. What do you need? To hide the car we're using and borrow another. And then what are you going to do? I turned the car to the right. We'll be there in a minute. I'll try to explain it to you then. Lenny wore a pair of old gray sweatpants, the kind with a tie waist, a pair of slippers, and a big dog t-shirt. He pressed a button and the garage door slid to a smooth close as soon as we entered. Lenny looked exhausted, but then again, I don't think Rachel and I were ready for our close-ups either. When Lenny saw the blood on Rachel, he took a step back. What the hell happened? Do you have any bandages? I asked. Cabinet over the kitchen sink. Rachel still had the cell phone in her hand. I need to get on the internet, she said. Look, Lenny said, we have to discuss this. Discuss it with him, Rachel said. I need web access. In my office, you know where it is. Rachel hurried inside. I followed, staying in the kitchen. She continued on to the den. We both knew this house well. Lenny stayed with me. They had recently renovated the kitchen into something French farm-esque and added a second refrigerator because four kids ate like four kids. The fronts of both fridges were overloaded with artwork and family photos and a brightly colored alphabet. The new one had one of those magnetic poetry sets. The words, I stand alone around the sea, ran down the handle. I started through the cabinet over the sink. You want to tell me what's going on? I found Cheryl's first aid kit and pulled it out. There was a shooting at our house. I gave him the bare bones, opening the first aid kit and checking the supplies. There'd be enough in here for now. I finally glanced at him. Lenny just gaped at me. You ran away from a murder scene? If I stayed, what would have happened? The police would have picked you up. Exactly. He shook his head and kept his voice low. They don't think you did it anymore. What do you mean? They think it was Rachel. I blinked, not sure how to react. Has she explained those photos to you? Not yet, I said. Then, I don't understand. How did they figure it was Rachel? Lenny rapidly outlined a theory involving jealousy and rage and my forgetting key moments before the shooting. I stood there, too stunned to respond. When I did, I said, That's nuts! Lenny did not reply. That guy with a flannel shirt just tried to kill us. And what ended up happening to him? I told you. Someone else was with him. He was shot. You saw someone else? No, Rachel. I saw where he was going. Come on, Lenny. You know better. I want to know about those photos on the CD, Mark. Fine. Let's go ask her. When we left the kitchen, I spotted Cheryl on the stairwell. She looked down at me, arms crossed. I don't think I had ever seen that look on her face before. It made me pause. There was some blood on the carpet, probably from Rachel. On the wall was one of those studio photos of all four kids trying to look casual in matching white turtlenecks against a white background. Children, and all that white. I'll take care of it, Lenny told her. You stay upstairs. We hurried through the den. A DVD case from the latest Disney movie lay splayed on top of the television. I nearly tripped over a wiffle ball and plastic bat. A game of Monopoly featuring Pokemon characters was spread across the floor in mid-game clutter. Someone, one of the kids, I assumed, had scrawled, "Do not touch a thing," on a piece of paper and laid it over the board. As we passed the fireplace mantel, I noticed that they'd recently updated the photographs. The kids were older now, in those images as in real life. But the oldest photograph, the formal dance image of the four of us, was gone. I don't know what that meant. Probably nothing. Or maybe Lenny and Cheryl were taking their own advice. It was time to move on. Rachel sat at Lenny's desk, hovering over the keyboard. The blood had dried down the left side of her neck. Her ear was a mess. She glanced up when she saw us and then went back to typing. I examined her ear. Severe damage. The bullet had scraped along the upper region. It had skimmed the side of her head, too. Another inch? Hell, another quarter inch. And she'd probably be dead. Rachel ignored me, even when I applied the Bactine and threw on a bandage. It would be good enough for now. I'd fix it for real when we had the chance. Bang, Rachel said suddenly. She smiled and hit a key. The printer began to whir. Lenny nodded toward me. I put the finishing touches on the bandage and said, "Rachel." She looked up at me. "We need to talk," I said. "No," she countered. "We need to get out of here. I just found us a major lead." Lenny stayed where he was. Cheryl slipped into the room now, her arms still folded. "What lead?" I asked. "I checked the logs on the cell phone," Rachel said. "You can do that?" "They're in plain view, Mark," she said, and I could hear the impatience. "The dialed and received call logs. It's pretty much standard on every phone." "Right." The dialogue didn't help. No numbers were listed, which means if the guy did dial out, it was to a blocked number. I was trying to stay with her. "Okay. But the received log is another story. There was only one incoming call on the list. According to the internal timer, it came in at midnight. I just checked the phone number in the reverse directory at switchboard.com. It's a residence. One Vern Dayton in Huntersville, New Jersey." Neither the name nor the city rang any bells. "Where is Huntersville?" "I map-quested it. It's near the Pennsylvania border. I zoomed in to within a few hundred yards. The house is all by itself out there. Acres of land in the heart of Nowheresville." A chill started in my center and spread. I turned to Lenny. "I need to borrow your car." "Hold up a second," Lenny said. "What we need here are some answers." Rachel stood. "You want to know about the photos on the CD?" "For starters, yes." "It's me in the pictures. Yes, I was there. The rest is none of your business. I owe Mark an explanation, not you. What else?" For once, Lenny didn't know what to say. "You also want to know if I killed my husband, right?" She looked at Cheryl. "Do you think I killed Jerry?" "I don't know what to think anymore," Cheryl said. "But I want you both out of here." "Cheryl," Lenny said. She shot him a look that could have downed a charging rhino. "They shouldn't have brought this to our doorstep." "He's our best friend. He's the godfather of our son. Which makes it that much worse. He drags this danger into our home, into the lives of our children?" "Come on, Cheryl, you're exaggerating." "No," I said. "She's right. We should get out of here now. Let me have the keys." Rachel grabbed the sheet out of the printer. "Directions," she explained. I nodded and looked at Lenny. His head was down. His feet rocked back and forth.